Why won't you debate me, Isaac? Why won't you respond to my comment, Andrew? You know, yeah, it's because you're not intellectually honest. And I think people who get caught up in that, where they can learn from the creator mindset is the thing that we all have to do in order to gain attention in the real world. And that is, you got to command the respect. You got to earn my attention. You got to find a way to say what you say that makes me want to listen and to dialogue with you. And I think many people who love to criticize, they kind of have this entitlement mindset about other people's attention, and they're always frustrated that no one is going to debate them. I have this superior argument and you're not listening. Well, welcome to the world of people who create things. In the real world, where you have to create things, you earn people's attention. Even if you have a great product, even if you have a great service, nobody owes it to you in the name of your arguments about being intellectually honest to give you their time. Earn it. Doesn't matter how good your arguments are, earn the attention. And that takes a creator's mindset. You gotta go beyond being a critic to do that.
Hi everyone, it's Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is September 27th. We are just 2 weeks away from the launch of the first Unversity Virtual Summit, Ideas into Action. I am currently in the process of putting together the event schedule. It is going to be 3 full days. Now, you'll have some breaks, you know, you'll be able to get away for lunch and all that. And we'll wrap up at a responsible time each evening. But remember, the event is coming Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the 11th, 12th, and 13th of October. There is still plenty of time to get tickets for this event. You can go to sspuniversity.com. Just spell it university, sspuniversity.com, to see all the details about the event. Right now, I'll just tell you about day one, because I'm going through and just trying to trim down the presentations a little bit at this point. You're going to see Steve Patterson talking about his pursuit of truth and his entire research process. We went off script in this one. I'm really glad we did. We talked about how to apply these skills to navigating the healthcare industry. Then Moritz Berling's awesome presentation on building a second brain and a third brain and a fourth brain. You didn't know you could have that many brains? Come find out what that's all about. Then Scott Hambrick and I have a delightful conversation on how to read a book or anything else and embracing A to discovery. And we will close out the day with Zach Slayback, who will be talking about how to successfully set yourself up to pursue any new project. And that's the first day, organizing your thoughts. I'm currently working on tightening up the second day. Again, if you want to learn more, go to sspuniversity.com. Well, I'm fresh off a trip to South Carolina, and I mean real fresh. I returned this morning at 3 a.m. It is now 10. I've slept for just a few hours, and I'm excited to get this show to you before the week concludes. It is a conversation that I recorded yesterday during my first visit to Praxis headquarters. You know all about Praxis. Their website is discoverpraxis.com. For those of you who are unfamiliar, I'll tell you, Praxis is an apprenticeship and I would say entrepreneurial skills training program that has been offering what I feel is an exciting and pretty innovative alternative to the traditional 4-year degree path. Is the traditional 4-year degree thing really even a path? What makes it sound so neat and tidy and well-planned and free of prickers? Like, you start here, you walk through, and ta-da, this is where you expected to be. And there's so many young people who are just flying autopilot into this really crucial life decision. And if they don't do their due diligence, if they don't do their research, and they don't plan accordingly, you don't know what's on the other side of that path. Remember that movie, The Blair Witch Project? That started out as just a few curious kids going down a path. Now, if you're in high school and you're trying to make this decision for yourself and you're listening to this and saying, is this guy telling me that if I go to college, I'm going to be killed by witches? I would think there'd probably be less than a, 5% chance of that happening. But is there a 21st century equivalent of being killed by witches in the woods here? Yeah, I think there is. Even though, you know, most of the news we hear about what's happening socially, culturally in higher education is the worst of the worst, we do see a real strong and steady growth of these, like, intellectually and emotionally poisonous social environments. And whether you buy into all of the orthodoxies being inculcated in the cathedral of higher education or not, there's a cost either way. Because either you buy in and you, you know, exit with an extremely confused worldview, or you don't buy in and you pay a price. And this isn't everybody everywhere, obviously, but there's a, certainly a price to pay in higher education if you resist this. It's a story we've told on this show many times over. And even though I went to college an entirely different time, I absorbed a lot of bad information there, very uncritically, you know, which in the end is my responsibility to run a good filter on what's coming into my mind. But I, you know, unfortunately, I didn't have those skills. And we know that the situation for many high schoolers is no better today. So in addition to skyrocketing tuition prices, I see that as a hidden cost. It's easier to go from known unknowns, right? You know you're ignorant. You know that you don't know a lot. Then, and, you know, again, like my, this is only my story, graduating thinking I knew everything about how the world worked and then having to unlearn all of that was a time consuming, it was an ongoing process. I'm still doing that. Obviously, the financial cost, and I paid a fraction of what people are going to pay today. And the opportunity cost. I think in this world, the opportunity cost is greater than ever. So while there's aspects of the experience for which I am grateful, I wish I had known more at the time. I would have made different decisions. But you live, you learn, you tell other people about your experience in a podcast. You present suggestions to help them avoid such a situation. One of those suggestions would be Praxis. DiscoverPraxis.com. My conversation today is with two prior School Sucks guests and one School Sucks co-host. Isaac Morehouse is the founder of Praxis. TK Coleman is the education director at Praxis. And Andrew is my co-host on The Discomfort Zone. Last week, the two of us went down to South Carolina for what I will call an income opportunity. And a tremendous bonus of that trip was getting to visit with TK and Isaac and see the Praxis headquarters. So here's what you need to know before we get started. They had beautiful audio equipment and video equipment at Praxis, and none of it was set up. They had just a splendid Scarlett Focusrite audio interface and some really nice RE20 Electrovoice microphones. I could not get their audio interface to connect with my computer and communicate with my recording software, but thanks to a listener named Darren Gill, who I consider a friend and such a good friend that I know that that's not even his name, Darren, 5 years ago, purchased for me a Zoom H4 recorder. I had it with me because that's usually how I record. We just couldn't hook up all four microphones to the Zoom. So what I did, I put the Zoom in the middle of the table and we just went for it. And even though the audio quality is not as good as what you would normally hear on this podcast anyway, it created something that I thought was kind of special. This feels much more like a conversation the four of us would have just sitting around a table in a restaurant. There's something that just, I don't know how to get around this, and I hope someday I figure it out. When you put the microphone up to your face, something changes. There's like a stiffening. So by not having to do that in this case, I felt like this conversation just flowed really nicely, really casually. Now, it had to be this way because of time constraints. Isaac had things coming up that day. TK had things coming up that day. Andrew and I had things to take care of before we got in the car that afternoon and drove all the way back to the City of Champions. So I'm glad I had the Zoom. Thanks again, Darren. And I know in the audience, there's plenty of admirers and appreciators of Praxis and what Praxis does and fans of Isaac and TK. So this was a joint production of School Sucks Podcast, The Discomfort Zone, and their show Office Hours. And if you're a fairly new listener and you love the show and you're going, Brett, what is this Discomfort Zone? The Discomfort Zone is a show that we do for supporters only, people who contribute on Patreon or people who are members of the AV Club or even people who support us on Subscribestar. And if you want to see how to do all those things so you can get access to two full seasons of spectacular, unsettling conversation, you can go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and see all our membership options there. So all that being said, let's get right to it. Huge thanks to Isaac Morehouse and TK Coleman for their hospitality. It was so great to visit and record with these guys. I hope you enjoy this. Thanks for listening. And we will continue Self-Discipline Month next week. It's going to be more than a month, huh? This one's over. Zach Slayback will be my next guest. We'll talk about automating self-discipline, developing trustworthy processes that require less human mental energy. If you follow Andrew Yang, you've probably heard about automation. It's all the rage right now. So Zach and I will explore how you can put the principles of automation to work for yourself, and maybe you wind up with your own freedom dividend. Gang? So that's coming up at the beginning of next week. All right, everybody. Again, thank you for listening. You will receive updates soon on the details of the schedule for the virtual summit, just 2 weeks away. In the meantime, have a great weekend. I hope you're enjoying your autumn. All right, bye.
Ride my seesaw, take this place on this trip.
So how do you guys introduce Office Hours Podcast?
Usually we just start like laughing about something, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we come in pretty unprepared. I always promise Isaac that I'll get him the notes a week before, then I get them in 30 seconds before, and we just come in cold.
It's like Narnia time. Like 1 week of TK's promise equals about 1 minute of real world. So if he says a week, you know, 5 days in advance, we're talking 30 seconds or something.
If I say I'll be there in 5 minutes or I'll only take 5 minutes, that could be 5 days.
How do you start School Sucks these days?
Oh, so many different ways. You never know.
Okay.
So this is actually what we're doing right now is three podcasts.
Ooh.
Office Hours.
Mm-hmm.
School Sucks. Andrew, who's in the fourth seat here, in the, what is this room? The Praxis?
Conference room.
Conference room.
World headquarters.
Andrew and I do a show called The Discomfort Zone for my supporters only, our supporters only. So people who support us on Patreon or through our membership program, they get access to this very personal conversation. How would you describe it, Andrew?
Well, it's kind of hard to describe because we cover so many different topics, but relationship bullshit. personal productivity, self-discipline, like this month, entrepreneurial mindsets and growth and all of that. But I want to say this recording right now is much in the vein of anything I've ever recorded in that no preparation was done. And the best things I've ever done in life require no preparation.
We should also point out,
if I prepare,
yeah,
I can only fail.
All right. Well, I hope this isn't the exception to the rule.
Oh, shit.
We should also point out, since no one can see this, that it is a shame how much audio equipment is sitting on this table right now, and we're using none of it.
Unused. Yeah. Yeah. So I've got to ask about your new show.
Yeah, because I think it's kind of like what you guys do, where you take, like, and we've gotten pretty bold with it, where now we're actually, like, soliciting advice to other people.
Oh, yeah, we think we're brilliant.
Oh, it's the best, yeah. You know.
But that's what you guys do, right? You take emails.
What allows you to do things that you wouldn't do on the School Sucks podcast? Is it just that the topic is different, or do you feel like because it's kind of a supporters only, you have like a level of freedom to talk about things in a different way?
I would say option two.
Okay.
Yeah. More personal.
You can get a lot more personal and more specific.
I just created a newsletter, like a weekly newsletter sort of documenting the startup process that we're going through with Crash. And I put it behind a paywall. I've never done this. I blog every day. I just create tons of content. It's always free. And it's $5 a month. And something about creating that little tiny, tiny paywall, I like feel so free to say stuff that I didn't even know I was sort of shielding a little bit, because I'm pretty transparent with my normal stuff.
Yeah.
But it's like I approach that newsletter in a different way. And it's really fun to write because I feel like I have the thin veneer of fiat paywall protecting me from the world.
You know, there is something comforting about it. And like I've been recording a podcast for over 9 years now, and I thought my entire life was on that show. Every embarrassing thing that ever happened to me, every relationship I was in was just public on the show. All details were out there. But then we get this paywall thing and a whole new world opens up. Mm. And you can go so much deeper and you don't realize that you're, like you said, shielding these specific pieces or, you know, I mean, you're never going to put it all out there.
Yeah.
But it gets
a
lot closer.
Oh, yeah. We're very close to it all out there. Yeah. I'm
honest. Oh, yeah. Rhett's like, wait a minute. Yeah. What have you been holding back? Because I've let it all.
I mean, the last step is just to do the show without any pants or underwear.
I was just going to say, I knew it was going to eventually. Then it's like Howard Stern at some point, you know.
What was our idea? Oh, so we did this gimmicky, like, self-improvement dopamine fast, where you deprive yourself of everything for ideally a 24-hour period. So we live streamed in the middle of that, and that was last week.
2 weeks ago.
Everything like food and water?
Food, except water.
Okay.
I had water with flavorless protein powder.
Mm-hmm. I just had water.
And I couldn't even finish it.
Caffeine, reading, your computer, your phone. So it's just you and the world and water.
Okay.
For a day. So it gets the gears turning in really interesting ways. So he and I went to a park outside Pittsburgh, and we just sat there and kind of loathed the day together. But I was also like, this is a really confronting, interesting experience. So glad we did it. I'm glad it ended, though, too.
Yeah, I had the opposite experience.
Yeah, Andrew hated it.
Mm. Yeah. What prompted you to do this? Did you read something about, like, a dopamine fast?
Well, so, oh, this might bring us to one of our topics for this conversation. Right now, on my show, we're focusing on self-discipline for this month, and it'll probably run into October, obviously, at this point. And I think one of the challenges that people have today, and I'd love to get your input on this as well, there's so many distractions. I mean, this is pretty basic at this point. There's so many distractions that people have a hard time focusing on their most important tasks, because it's never like the choice between, well, you know, I'm going to do my highest value task for the day, or I'm going to watch a YouTube video, or I'm going to do my highest value task for the day, or I'm going to smoke a cigarette, or I'm doing my highest value task for the day, or open a incognito window for whatever, you know, like, but it's a bunch of little choices, of little trade-offs where people are like, there's so many ways to get this counterfeit happiness now. And that becomes, you know, cumulatively a trade-off for maybe pursuing the bigger things that a lot of us should be working on. So I was just exploring the chemical aspects of self-discipline earlier, and I said, why don't we try this? So a listener actually suggested that we do it. So we tried it for a day. We didn't really get much out of it.
No, not at all.
I mean, won't do it again.
For me, it was just, you know, getting back to sort of the crux of this recording, self-discipline, I went from 2 years ago having absolutely zero, and I don't have a ton now, but the chasm between then and now is bigger than anybody else can kind of take claim for. But the dopamine fast was just an exercise in self-discipline. Can I do this? And the answer is, yeah, for the most part, but man, it's not worth it.
It's the kind of thing that, like, a self-improvement blogger would do to tell people that he did.
Yeah, and it's also the kind of thing that a self-important person would do to proclaim how amazing they are.
I've always found, like, I get really disappointed in different experiments like that most of the time. So, like, I've gone with no caffeine, no alcohol, no sugar for either one at a time or all of them for, like, as long as a month. And I literally don't notice a difference. I don't sleep any better. I don't feel any different.
All, like, these things that I kick out just to try it.
And I'm kind of just like, yeah, I have a little bit less fun because I enjoy the ritual of drinking a cup of coffee or sipping some whiskey at the end of the day. Yep. But otherwise, I don't really notice. Some people get, like, a really big improvement. They sleep
better. I'm so jealous of those people.
I know, me too.
They just go, oh yeah, I gave up this and it was phenomenal. Or I started meditating every day and then this happened. Right. And all these things fell into place. And it's like, I tried it all. Over and over.
I wonder, let me tell on myself a little bit, since this is three shows and one of them is a more personal show. I think I've been really enthusiastic about something new and then I'll go to press with it too soon. On my show, I'll be like, I'm doing this thing, and it's the best thing.
It's life-changing.
And then, Brett says it's the best thing. I guess I'll try.
Well, where I am now with a lot of these, like, self-management, time management, you know, diet, fit, all these things that I've talked about through the years, is I'm taking essences of them and continuing on with them. But if I heard myself talk about, like, David Allen's Getting Things Done, which I'm sure you guys
familiar with. Yeah, TK's.
If you go back and listen to me talk about that in 2013... I was, you know, it's like, oh, here's the next GTD guru, Brett of School Sucks. But now it's been, like, streamlined and customized so much. Like, if David Allen saw it, he'd be like, stop saying that's getting things done.
Okay, so TK, I want to hear, TK has a very interesting relationship to, like, self-help tactics, practices, whatever. He thinks all of them are absolutely amazing and the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
But, like, do you actually implement them and use them, or do you just sort of like them theoretically? I can never quite tell. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm always the opposite. I'm always like, I don't need some system or some, I'm very skeptical of them. I usually don't care, but I don't know. Like, you've done Getting Things Done, right? Do you still, what is your take on, you know?
Sure. So I like to use the phrase that Isaac hates. It's experiments and personal development to refer to these types of things.
I love it.
And,
Do I hate that phrase?
It's like my other phrase. I need to trademark. It's called Zone of Power. Maybe we'll get into that later. Like, Isaac really...
It is cheesy.
Basically, really, what you're saying is Isaac doesn't want to get any better. He's perfect as it is.
Basically, that's it.
Jerk.
But see, I kind of look at it as similar to a video game. You don't play a video game in order to be transformed. You play a video game in order to have fun with novelty, right? Novelty is an important aspect of experiencing fulfillment. So when I travel, for instance, I travel because I have somewhere that I want to go, or if I try out a new restaurant, I want to see what it's like, but I don't put any pressure on myself to go to Twitter or Instagram or write a blog post about how much my life has changed as a result of trying out this new restaurant or visiting this new city. It's a very selfish thing. I'm introducing novelty in my experience and I'm having fun. So if I do an experiment where I say, I'm not drinking coffee for a week, I don't need that to work. There's no concept of this working or not working. It's me doing something different and just exploring a way of life that may not be normal for me. And then I move on to something else.
But I don't think that's selfish. Being selfish would be blogging about it or praising yourself for it or recording a podcast about it.
Yeah, well, so I mean selfish in the sense that I don't feel the need to transform this into a service or product or an essay that I give to the world to teach them some insight. It's for me and my experience of life.
Or also like seeking the approval of other people.
Yeah.
It's almost like you lack this utilitarianism or pragmatism. Like, I'm always immediately like, okay, what's the outcome? How's that going to benefit me? What am I going to get for it? And you sort of, over the years, you'll read some book about some new philosophy or whatever. And I'm like, cool, how's that working out? Like, what are the outcomes? And you're like, you wouldn't even think to ask the question. You're like, no, it's just an interesting thing. And I kind of get that. And like, I wish I had more of that, but I'm always looking for, how's this going to give me something that I can use because I'm trying to go somewhere. And it's just interesting that you have like you treat, I think, concepts and practices more as playthings just for their own sake in a way that I struggle with. I wish I did more.
Can you think of an example that particularly annoyed you?
Man, I remember back in the day, me and TK were, I don't know if you were working at the like nursing home or whatever, night shifts, whatever it was. And you got really into, well, now it's sort of been popularized into like law of attraction or whatever, but just the idea of the patterns of your mindsets and the way that you think about the world affecting the outcomes that you get. And like, you know, you think about all these positive things and you attract them to yourselves, whatever. And you're talking to me about all these books and stuff. And I'm like, cool. So how's that working out for you? Like, I think I said one time, how do you explain your life in light of your beliefs? And he just started laughing because to him, he saw no contradiction. Like, oh, it's totally true that you can attract all of your dreams to yourself.
Yeah.
While I'm attracting my dreams to myself.
I'm completely broke. You know, like, I have nothing going on in the outer facets of my life. And I'm telling Isaac, like, oh, dude, this is so cool. This is the idea about how you create your own
reality. And I'm thinking, like, well, why don't you spend less time reading those books till 2 in the morning and just, like, go get a better job? That's going to be more likely to get you to where you want to go, isn't it?
You know, I feel like I've had a personal shift kind of from an area of pragmatism like you, Isaac, to where more of where TK's at. Like, with getting things done, I tried to implement every single step. Like, I tried to break it down and do everything I could with the organization first and purge everything and delete everything and file everything and then move on from there. But at a certain point, I kind of ran out and I used GTD as just an organizational tool and that was it, not an implementing or action-taking tool. From there, I branched out and started absorbing more and more and more and realized that I'm not going to follow one method for the desired outcome because that method's not going to work for me. Mm. Nothing is going to work for me other than a collective that just sort of pushes my mindset forward or my habits or my discipline or whatever it is and just keeps it going in the right direction. So that's my whole goal, but I want to absorb as much as possible and I'm not anymore looking for the immediate outcome, the immediate results. So like if you ask me, what are the results from what you're trying here? I don't know yet. And whatever sticks with me for more than a few weeks, that's the result. It's whether it's an organizational tool or a way of thinking about things. But yeah, I kind of went from the very pragmatic approach where I was skeptical of everything unless you could prove results to me to more of where TK's at.
And in a sense, I think this is consistent with that philosophy of education that espouses play as the foundation for learning. You can approach learning as, hey, you cannot spend time on this unless you can justify it in terms of how it's going to benefit your career or make you a better human being. Or you can just have fun with it and see what remains with you
without effort,
maybe,
right?
Maybe that's,
and that's how you discover things about yourself.
The fun thing and the time horizon. So I guess if I don't get a clear outcome, one outcome for me is just that I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And if I don't enjoy a book in the first 20 or 30 minutes, mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, I'm done. And I think you have a much broader tolerance for, let me give it more time. Let me play with it more. And so it's sometimes like, okay, well, this isn't doing anything for me. It's not fun.
Well, how often do you go back and read a book or listen to a book more than once?
Quite a bit, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Like there's a number of books that every time I read them or go back to them, I get something out of them. And so I'll go back to those often. I have a low tolerance for exploring new things if they're going to waste my time. So I let TK read all the books mm-hmm. and then he filters the parts that are good to me. And same with like music. I always want that friend who's always exploring new music and they can send me the 2 good tracks out of the 20 crappy ones they listen to.
See, but there's a frustrating thing to be in TK's position in that case, because he's absorbed all this. He's deciphered what's good, what's bad, what not to waste your time on. And now he has all this knowledge and he wants to give it to other people to expedite their process. But for the most part, the people listen to you.
So that's not frustrating at all. So the answer is no, but not frustrating at all.
Yeah, so I would always rather listen to TK tell me a synopsis of a book or a movie than watch it or read it myself, because it's better. Mostly because he picks movies that aren't that good, but his version, his interpretation of them is good.
Okay, so I guess my question is, how do I get people to listen to me more?
Ooh. So for me, I think it's all about being more selfish, right? To get to a point where you can be completely free to enjoy things without other people listening to you being a part of the reward. So I don't look at Isaac as being the one who gets the real benefit, right? Mm-hmm. Like I go watch 100 bad movies and then I tell them to him and like he gets the real benefit. I look at me as the one who gets the real benefit because I enjoy the process of exploration. I don't want to be the guy that has someone else watch the bad movies and tell me the summary. I'm not that practical. I'm more playful. I want to be the guy that watches the horrible movies. And then after like 8 hours of just nothing, there's this amazing insight that pops out of a terrible movie and it just feels so awesome. To me, that's the reward. And if someone listens to that, that's fantastic because I get to share that beauty. But it's my experience. It's for me, you know?
Right. It's modeling, you know? I mean, this is what we always say when we talk about like trying to convince people, whether we're talking about our philosophical ideas, our ideas about education, politics, whatever. It's like you can have what you think are the best arguments that you've practiced in the shower for years. And somebody just swats them away and goes on like you don't even exist. But if you can model those things consistently with the people that you care about over time, you do a much better job. So, and that's kind of what you're saying here. It's very related to that.
One more quick thing on this too. I have actually come to believe that for any given idea that you feel passionate about, there's always someone listening. You never have the problem of no one wants to hear what I'm interested in. The only problem you'll ever have is this particular individual that I really want to listen to me. Maybe that's my brother that I'm trying to help. Maybe that's my spouse that I want to buy into this idea. They won't buy into it. And that can be frustrating because you're attached to that outcome, you know? But I think there's always someone listening if you just put yourself out there and don't care about who the particular individuals are.
I remember I came across, this was years and years ago, but an essay by Albert J. Nock called Isaiah's Job. And he talks about the prophet Isaiah in the Old Testament that he's out there and he keeps preaching what he's supposed to preach and nobody's listening. And finally, God tells him, like, no, there's a remnant that's listening. Not the masses, but there's a remnant hidden among them. You'll never meet them and you'll never get the reward of knowing who they are and having them say thank you or whatever. But you're not speaking to the masses, you're speaking to the remnant. And that, like, that I've come back to that so
many
times.
That's so encouraging.
It's so encouraging. And every once in a while, you see hints and indications that, like, they're out there. And that's a big thing. Hey, I want to ask you a question, but actually all of us, because we're all podcasters here, and this is something I think about a lot. And with School Sucks, you've been going for a long time, so I'm sure this is relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you ever feel conflicted about, you started this podcast, the School Sucks podcast, and it's about a particular philosophy of education, whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
And it works, and it gets popular, and it builds over time, and it becomes a big thing. And now you have this audience that likes you and likes to hear what you say. But at some point, you kind of run to the end of that really tightly defined topic. And now the question is, do I, just because I have an audience that I don't want to lose, just broaden out and talk about anything? Or do I say, mission accomplished, we're folding up shop, right? Like, I wonder about that. We haven't gotten to that point with Office Hours, but I get to a point sometimes where, okay, we got the theme of this show, and like, now I've kind of exhausted it. Now I feel like I'm just repeating myself every episode. But I have this audience. Is it like selling out to just be like, well, I don't want to lose my audience, so I'll just start producing something else totally different? Or is it just like a natural evolution? Do you ever feel conflicted with that? Like,
school sucks is now broader than just talking about why school sucks. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. do you ever feel like, are you becoming too attached to just having an audience and making podcasts for the sake of making them because you can? Because you see this happen to some podcasts, right? Mm-hmm. Eventually, they're just like Tim Ferriss, you probably could have wrapped up about 50 episodes ago and we get the basic idea. You know what I mean? I'm not saying that to pick on just him, but like the whole thematic podcast. You know what I mean? You ever feel that conflict?
I do sometimes. You're describing, I think that all went through my head maybe in like 2011.
Okay.
Yeah. And
you're an old hat, man.
Well, when I started, a lot of it was like everything that had been up against this wall from the work I used to do, like in, you know, educational service. I used to sit in meetings in schools with guidance counselors and, you know, teachers and parents ready to explode, you know, while I'm reading John Taylor Gatto in my spare time and then bringing that energy into this meeting where I just have to sit there and go, yeah, we'll try that, modifications, you know. So when I started the podcast, it was a way of like turning a valve.
The dam broke.
Yeah.
No, it was a valve, you know. I don't think it was a dam. I was keeping, it could have been a dam breaking, but I think because I could edit it and I could plan out what I wanted to do, it was just like turn the valve, release some pressure. And then after I did that for maybe like 6 months, I was like, okay, all the pressure's gone.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, the podcast became a job and I had to give that other work up to be able to do this full time. And then I found out that a lot of the motivation that I had to keep getting angry and telling these stories was coming from the work. And now I wasn't doing it. I mean, now I haven't done any like tutoring or anything in 5 years. So the first phase of this was, I'm done being angry and unconstructive about school sucking. Like, how many different ways can we talk about this? So then we said, all right, well, if school's not education, what is? And maybe we got an extra 8 years to go into that, right? Like, it's, you know, when I'm giving people an elevator pitch about it, I say, we teach the skills that I think are valuable that school neglects. And one of the most common responses is like, oh, well, you'll never run out of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and especially as the world changes and school doesn't change that much. I mean, you know, Andrew does a lot of work with schools like charter schools, tech schools, and you see some exciting and innovative things happening even in public education.
Sure, but it gets old real fast. Like, right. None of it's exciting anymore.
Right, right. For the most part, it's following a model that it has for, you know, a century. While the world is more dynamic than ever. So I don't think we'd ever run out of things to talk about. When did I first connect with you guys? Maybe like 4 years ago?
Yeah.
So there's no shortage of interesting people. Like, I'm sending out a signal. It's like, okay, I feel this way about school. I feel this way about self-education and a kind of self-liberation through self-education. And that signal goes out and it attracts a lot of exciting, interesting people to me. So I could do this forever, I think.
And I think that model works when you're coming from a standpoint of lifelong learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's endless.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was, I think I first thought of this when I was like 8 years old. I was like, how could I get on TV? Or how could I, like, we used to go to the Red Sox games and I'd be like, how could I get in that booth up there where the guys just like talk about the game during the game?
Yeah.
You know, how could I do that? So this went through all these different like iterations of, my parents found me a sportscaster camp for like high school kids.
No way.
And they sent me there when I was like 10. So it was like me and a bunch of dorky high school kids at this camp in Concord, New Hampshire. And I went to that for years. And then I majored in communications, right? Because those were the only paths that I could see in the 80s and the 90s. And, you know, I was like, all right, so I got to find my way to being behind this microphone, to being able to say, to talk about things that are important to me to lots of people. And then, like, I just happened to be fortunate enough to be here at the right time to find a way to do it that I like to do it. So even if, like, a day comes where it's, like, episode 1000 of School Sucks, we've said everything there is to say, thanks for listening and take care, I would immediately have to do something else like that.
Yeah.
Because that was, you know, even though I couldn't define why it was important most of my life, I was like, how do I get in front of a bunch of people to say things that I think are important and hopefully have them be interested? And if they're not interested, go find people who are interested. Because I found lots of like situations in teaching where people, they weren't interested, you know?
Yeah.
Well, a far less positive outlook on the same question.
Oh, boy.
Well, no, I think the lifelong learning model lends itself to that nicely. But think about, you know, all the things you love, whatever media it might be, TV show, you know, YouTube series. At a certain point, it has a shelf life. It runs out. It gets stale.
You jump the shark.
So either they quit, and it's great, and it goes down in history as that was phenomenal, or it just keeps going and going and slowly fades into obscurity, and whatever legend it may have had, if it ended when it should have, dies with it fading into obscurity.
Yeah.
So I live my life by philosophies that I learned from the show Seinfeld. And one of the greatest things that I hold true to in almost every aspect of my life is when George was being praised by his coworkers after telling a funny joke and then leaving the room. He would leave on a high note. So I think there's a lot to that, actually. I know it sounds simplistic and really dumb, but leaving on a high note makes everyone think, that was the best.
Yeah.
Whether it's a TV show, a person, a podcast.
There goes that great guy.
Yeah.
See,
don't come back and ruin it.
And
don't give yourself the chance to fuck it up.
And I struggle with this a little bit because I have like a little bit of that David Bowie syndrome or whatever. Like, you do something and people like it. And the fact that they like it starts to make me feel trapped.
Yep.
And I'm like, I'm going to do something and reinvent myself that shocks everybody. And part of it is like a good impulse. Part of it's like I'm a little overly paranoid about being trapped. And so, like, and podcasting is a very difficult medium in this way.
No, I agree. And
I've learned if you do anything, even if you have seasons, you have a break for a little bit, your audience just plummets. And podcasts, it's a very slow, steady building type of audience. And any drop off, any stoppage. And so I had the Isaac Morehouse podcast going for a couple years, interview show, pretty open-ended, had a little bit of a theme. But, and after like a couple years, I was like, okay, I'm tired of hearing myself talk. I'm going to quit. And then I'm going to do the Forward Tilt podcast, which is just a short 50 episodes, once a week, 10 minutes, and it's a thematic thing. And I quit that. And I'm like, all right, well, we got to do, let's do Office Hours. And we need Career Crashers. And I end up getting bored. And now I look back and I'm like, I should have, even if I just kept the same RSS feed and changed the name.
Yeah.
The Isaac Morehouse podcast actually had a really good following going, and it was growing, and it was really, and then like, I dropped it because I felt annoyed and I felt trapped. And I keep like creating new ones because I'm like, no, I got to reinvent myself. But I'm sort of like, maybe I'm losing all the momentum and that's a bad idea, but I want the freedom to, you know, I don't know. I have this love-hate relationship.
No, I get it.
With audiences.
I think podcasting lends itself to consistency. You have to be consistent to keep that going. If you're inconsistent, even if it's a great show, if you don't put it out every week, every month, whatever it might be, you're going to get drop off. You're never going to grow as much as you want. But we started a ridiculous comedy show over 9 years ago. And at the time, podcasting was so innocent. Like, anything you said would be funny. And it was great. We were hilarious, and we didn't know what we were doing.
Right.
But as the years go on, you can't recycle the same garbage over and over. So you, like you were saying, you sort of reinvent yourself, or you don't want to get trapped in this mindset. While we might have been trapped in dick and fart jokes, we had to make them better.
Yeah.
And better and better.
And they can keep getting better.
That's the unbelievable thing.
So I always struggle with this. Okay, at what time do I pull the Costanza?
Yeah.
Right? Like, it kind of feels like I should pull it. I should have pulled it 5 years ago. I should pull it today.
You see things where it's like, okay, this guy's just showing up because he's making X amount per episode because he has this giant baked-in audience and he's just been mailing it in for the last couple years, whatever. And like, I never want to be bored of myself. That's probably my greatest fear. And it's really tempting if you start to, if people start to like your little brand. And even if you're tired of your brand and you're ready to grow out of it, it's really tempting to stay with it.
It's easier and comfortable.
I think what I've learned about myself professionally is I will do something for as long as I enjoy doing it and not many weeks or days longer than
that. You have a low pain tolerance, which is good.
Yeah. And, it, you know, I used to feel like I was just really lazy. Like, I, you know, I would teach at this school or I would work with this group or on this campus and then tutoring and all these different kinds of tutoring that I did. And eventually I just have a story about why I wasn't helping anybody, you know? And this is the only thing I've ever done in my life where I can't make that story, right? Because it's like there's some kind of pressure to move on.
Yeah.
Even if it's lateral, but usually to move up, to do something new, to make more money, to have new challenges.
I'm not suggesting you should quit, by the way.
No, I was wondering if this was an intervention.
I'm genuinely asking for myself. I have a problem of cutting bait too soon.
No, I totally feel that way. Like, I say, okay, this is a living. If I had just kept it as a hobby, would I be enjoying it more, right? Because I work with him on this comedy show that we won't talk about here, but it's just something that we do on the weekend, you know? And it's like one of the highlights of my week every week.
See, that's what I found happening with my own podcast. I would bring TK on Fridays to just do a free-for-all.
Yeah.
And then I would bring on guests, you know, once a week on other episodes. And I found myself getting stressed and kind of annoyed by the scheduling and the whatever and the preparing for the guests. And like the Fridays with TK was like this outlet I looked forward to all week. And so finally I was like, well, why am I doing this? Let's just make the whole thing me and TK talking. And then that eventually evolved into to office hours. But it's like, you don't know sometimes when do you push through and be like, no, 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 I just got to persist through the part where I'm bored or whatever and figure out how to keep it interesting.
Yeah, that probably comes across to the listeners too, though.
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
No, I did, and I quit the show in 2011. And I didn't post an episode for like 6 months. And it was actually this other comedy show. This guy in Chicago just does this ridiculous show called Red Bar Radio, right? He had a business partner who seized control of his whole operation, took it over, took his domain name, stole a bunch of money from him, and the guy was just left with nothing, right? This was 2011. Then he comes back on Halloween. His show is better than ever. Like his website, his production values, it's amazing. And I was really inspired because even though this is just some, it's not, I don't want to call it lowbrow. It's a pretty high level, it's pretty inventive kind of comedy. But this guy just reappeared and he's like, no, this is my thing. No one's taking it away from me. And for me, 8 years ago, that was really meaningful. It's like, oh, I could have my own thing. This might be the only Brett's own thing that there is. I mean, I don't know if it will be or not, but this could be it. So why just let this identity go? Because maybe I'm a little bored with it. And certainly all the best stuff with School Sucks happened since I made that decision and said, this is a thing that I own. This is a reflection of me or you know, a projection of me out into the world. And I should take some pride in that. And I should protect that.
Yeah.
While totally like that, what you're describing was what led me to feel that way. And I've felt that way a couple times since then. Like, I'm phoning it in a little bit. But one of the things that's actually been really helpful, because we're talking about, you know, philosophy and ideas, is that there's always new people discovering this, right? Yeah. So I've gotten into this trap of thinking, everybody's heard this before, right? I don't think we probably, from maybe like 100 people left from our original audience, and everybody else is new, right? There's like, there's names that I see. And I say, wow, that person's been listening a long time. I remember them sharing stuff back in like 2009. But then I go on Instagram and I read comments. And, you know, somebody just makes a comment about homeschooling or government indoctrination camps. And I go, that's like the kind of thing we were saying 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, this person is where we were 10 years ago because they're 24 and they're just coming to all this stuff. So I think there is that evergreen audience appeal of this, is that there's always, it's not like school, I mean, school is out there advertising hard for my podcast, you know, and there's always people coming to that realization. So I think as long as I can maintain enthusiasm, which I'm able to do by connecting with lots of, you know, really exciting, intelligent, inspiring people, who are living very kind of dynamic. The other thing I noticed too is like a lot of people don't do the same thing for multiple years, especially when they're in their 20s.
Yep.
You know, like we're mutual friends with Zach. We all are. Zach's my neighbor. Lives right around the corner from me. And I just like, wow, that guy's always doing something different. You know, and I know so many people like that who they were here a year ago and they're just not staying still. They're onto the state, or they're clearly building something, or they're at least looking for something, moving a lot to find that thing. And I like connecting with people like that. I like that energy. Sometimes I worry that I've been doing the same thing for too long, but there's almost infinite ways to do what I do.
Yeah.
You know, and I am looking for some kind of reinvention or new challenge. And we found one. You know, we're starting our virtual summits in a couple of weeks, but that's just one thing.
It's kind of that process of like, what is the consistent part of my identity, my mission, or the essence of who I am that's going to be there, and trying to figure out what that is, which is like a big part of sort of growing up, while at the same time, what are the parts of me that are continually morphing in pursuit of that sort of core value? Who do I become and how am I leveling up? I don't know. How do you, TK, keep it if you feel like you're getting stale or phoning it in? What do you do?
Yeah. Well, you and I have talked about this topic before, the whole issue of not being boxed in by your brand. and how a brand can be this really awesome thing that you build that opens doors for you, creates opportunities for you. But it can also become a burden because you can say, my brand is I'm the guy that talks about nutrition. But right now, I'm just interested in financial literacy, where I built my audience talking about financial literacy. But now I just want to talk about relationships. And we limit ourselves because
I talk about education and professional development, but I want to talk about race and nobody will ask me.
right? That's me.
Yeah.
And your brand can become kind of this trap. So I think one way to look at it is to say, hey, when do I recognize that I'm at my high note and I should walk away? But another way to approach it is to say, how can I figure out a way to adapt what I have already built to the person that I'm now becoming? So I think one great example of this is Jordan Harbinger, The Art of Charm. When he first started that podcast, it was all about dating, game,
pickup podcast, right?
Yeah.
What happens to those guys? They always get married and then it becomes about different things.
Yeah, and at that age and stage, that's what he was interested in. And it was a very successful brand. But then as he got older, he's starting to be interested more in health and fitness and networking and business because he changed. And he didn't walk away from the podcast. He didn't even change the title of it. He said, I'm going to challenge my audience to grow with me.
Mm-hmm.
And he simply just started talking about what he was interested in. And, you know, some people may have fallen off and said, oh, I just wanted the dating stuff, so I'll only listen to the older episodes. But his audience grew with him. And I think sometimes you have to accept that challenge of not just serving your audience from the place that you were, but saying, I'm going to push you guys to grow with me a little bit. And I trust that the people who fall away are the people that are not for me at this time. And I'll keep some people and I'll bring other people on, you know. But I don't think there's ever a point where you got to walk out of the room. I think the true meaning of walking out of the room is the moment where you say, I'm not going to be so afraid of my audience that I hide what I really want to talk about with them, just because of the topics they've associated me with over the years.
Mm. So in 10 years, Office Hours will be like an NBA conspiracy theory podcast.
Well, I love that idea of, you know, your audience kind of growing with you. And when I record, I talk to avatars. Not avatars, actual people. Like I picture people that I know. Sarah will like this. Jessica will like this. Joe will like this. You know, and these are real people. Every relationship that I have outside of family at this point in my life came from this show.
Mm.
Right? Directly. I mean, that's how we met.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I met.
Well, not your show.
No. But you knew who I was. You guys had me on your comedy show in 2013 because I was Brett from School Sucks. Otherwise, I would have just been some guy.
We just wanted Osborne on, and he said we should have you on.
Oh.
We said, what's this? I don't know.
Osborne was a benefactor of a lot of the Free State stuff back in the day.
Podcasting is a very incestuous world, too, by the way. Like,
oh, it's the worst.
Everybody interviews everybody. But it's actually cool, too. Like, you get... Eventually, you build this really interesting network of people who have similar interests. Mm-hmm. Like, they're all trying to build audiences and get different guests and whatever. And you kind of, it's like this secret society that you join once you are a podcast host and you start inviting guests on and whatever. And it kind of gives you access to a lot of cool people.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a little silly too when everybody's just interviewing each other all the time. But like, it's also fun.
It was certainly like that in New Hampshire. But now in Pittsburgh, like the, you know, Brett's show is different. But the comedy show, we don't have Skype people.
No.
It's either in person or nothing. And now that we're in Pittsburgh, it's nothing.
Right.
Okay.
I do like the idea of it not being such a closed circle, though. You know, like I feel like, come on my show and agree with me.
Yeah.
You know? And I wish I could do more different types of shows. And I kind of gave up on that idea because they're like, all right, the people who disagree with me are teachers and they'll never talk to me, or they're progressives and they'll never talk to me. So it just.
You would like to do more like debate or disagree?
I don't want it to be an echo chamber. The problem is,
I love echo chambers. I'm a big fan.
Tell me more about that.
I don't like debate. I think it's a really bad format. I don't think anybody has ever learned anything.
I think it can evolve. I think it can be.
It's a form of entertainment that I don't find really very entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
To me, all the times when I've learned things and enjoyed the process of learning has been when I've been reading or listening to something that's like, there was something that inside me kind of felt like there was something here, and then someone put it into words, and it sort of shattered my paradigm a little bit, but in a way that was like, yes, that's what I've been trying to wrap my head around. Whereas two people just get butting heads with totally different paradigms, it just sounds like noise to me.
And it ends in frustration.
It's too dissonant. Yeah. TK loves debate, though. He always wants to debate.
It's far easier. Like, when we first met, you know, I met you down here. We had lunch, and you were going on and on and on about your new startup. And
I tend to do that.
No, it was great, because I basically kept pointing to Brett and going, you see? This is what I've been saying. And now this guy, who's smarter than me, is saying the same thing. People should listen to me more.
Oh, it was about giving advice to one of our friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was the best feeling ever, hearing somebody else take my thoughts exactly and parrot them back to somebody who's been hearing me say it for a while.
Yeah.
Not that I wasn't listening.
No,
I listened.
Just saying, it's reinforcing. It's that echo chamber, but this is the most pure, perfect example of it.
There's a blog post by Brian Kaplan called How to Build Your Own Beautiful Bubble, and he's basically defending the idea of like, yeah, I live in a bubble of other free market economists, whatever else, and I have crafted that bubble on purpose, and I have a very high quality of life, and I enjoy it. And I get in information from the outside world when I want to, but why would I want to put myself in a world where I'm annoyed by the people around me all the time?
I don't know. There's something about it that's kind of like a softening, right? Like, you, Tucker Carlson has some academic on, right? And this person just doesn't have a sharp edge to them at all. And they wind up like, oh, some Fox News guy. Oh, of course, I'll go on his show and destroy him. And they're just completely unprepared to deal with any of his questions because it's completely alien to them. They've never even had anyone challenge their ideas effectively before. So I find this like from working at home too, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'll just do whatever I want. All day. I'll wear what I want. I'll eat when I want. Now, I have a pretty tight schedule that I try to keep for myself, but I have a lot of freedom, too. I go out into the world, and suddenly this is like, there's seven people in line at the drugstore? This is an outrage, you know? So I feel like there's this softening from not going out and having those kinds of challenges and discomforts. You get softened. And sometimes I feel like I came into this world like I was listening to NPR. I was painting houses when I was teaching, right? And I would listen to like Bill Maher. And I just pause my iPod and start arguing on a ladder with myself, or, you know, pretending to be arguing with Bill Maher because I was the only one there and this was okay to do. That's where I got the energy to be a podcaster, or fantasizing about how the arguments I was having with family could have gone better. So that was almost like having muses. Now I have none of that. You know, the only critics I have who are persistent are like people I really don't want to deal with because they're like dark and kind of stalkery.
Yeah.
You know, I wish they weren't because they might have something, they might have, you know, valuable insights. So
there's like a calibration to like the amount of fresh air that you let into your bubble. You kind of need some level. So like, I feel like I have more than enough, just enough where like things that I see on Twitter that leak through, because I don't follow the news, but it leaks through from people I follow on Twitter or people in my neighborhood who are sort of just traditional, go to school, whatever, the conversations, I get just enough to rile me up that I'm like, okay. And most of my interactions I like to keep to people that I find interesting and that don't drive me crazy and depress me. But I agree, there is a level of like, you got to stay sharp. And if I blog every day. Mm-hmm. Some days I sit there and I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to write about today. Literally, I can open Twitter, click on trending, and in 30 seconds, I'm angry enough to write a blog post. So, like, you can go and get a little bit of that outside world coming into your bubble.
Yeah.
Well, you know, so there's an interesting thing, too, because I feel like if you're trying to build something, if you're trying to be productive, debate really can be a distraction. I absolutely love debate, but a lot of the people that love to prioritize, you know, like picking apart what you say and going back and forth, a lot of those people don't build anything. They don't actually get anything done. And there comes a point in your life where you say, look, I want to create results. I don't just want to feel good about myself or having rich ideas. I want to create results. And so, you know, Isaac and I experience this all the time. Like you can go, let's say, on your blog or on Twitter, and you can write an essay about how you don't need a college degree to be successful. And you can make your point, but because points have to be finite, there's a point where you just got to stop talking and you can't address every possibility. And then someone will come on and be like, yeah, well, technically you have to go to college if you want to do law, you know, or if you want to be a physician. And yeah, right. Like everybody points this out, like, you know, we don't know this kind of thing. Right. But it's like, all right, am I going to sit here and argue with this person as if I truly have something to learn from that encounter? Or am I just going to take the risk of them thinking that I'm arrogant, them thinking that I'm too good for debate, and I'm just going to keep building? Because I'm not writing that article in order to philosophize with people like that. I'm writing that article because I'm marketing something to an audience that agrees with my core assumptions. And I'm doing this as a process of building. So I think sometimes if you want to get things done, you do have to opt out of arguments.
The critic mindset and the creator mindset yeah, are very hard to maintain within the same brain at the same space of time. So like criticism, critique is a valuable skill. I mean, it's part of deconstructing arguments, etc. But it's also very addictive. And the better you get at it, the more you want to do it. And you can't flip the switch from being a critic to being a creator easily at all. They're very different. Creators are just like, yeah, whatever, I don't care. Like, oh, you know, you ask somebody, ask a typical entrepreneur who's built a bunch of businesses. They go to a movie and they come away from it. Their typical, this is a stereotype, is going to be like, yeah, it was pretty good. It was pretty cool, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Versus somebody who's usually unemployed, angry all the time. They're going to give you an hour-long dissection of everything that's wrong with it. And it's going to be more interesting. And they're going to be good at that job. But they're going to really struggle to get out in the world and create.
Now, take those traits, you know, the critic versus the person who takes action and implements and grows. And what TK was saying, yeah, it makes perfect sense to ignore those or do your best to push those away if they're not productive in sort of casual conversations and casual interactions. But apply that to, like, close personal relationships.
Yeah.
Like your significant other. And how damaging is that? Or maybe not damaging, but how much growth does that just prevent from happening?
You mean like if you ignore it?
No. If you are in a relationship with somebody who is that critic, who is that person that never grows, but constantly has something to say or constantly has input or some sort of, you know, argument with whatever your thoughts are. Like, you could just be like, look, I'm just trying to get X, Y, and Z done. And they go, oh, well, you're doing it wrong because of this, that, and the other, and you shouldn't even try. Or they just hold you back from growing. I've been in relationships where that is absolutely the case. And I think I've flipped the coin. And I'm looking for somebody who is just growing and doesn't have time to debate. If anyone's debating them, they're just stepping over them and continuing forward. Yeah. And I think that's dangerous too, because you don't ever stop to think about what you're doing and you just keep growing. But getting into deep personal relationships with those types of people, the critics, so to speak, is horribly damaging. Getting back to the Free State Project.
What if one of them gets inside your head?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a real value to that skill set. Sure. I don't wanna, and personalities who tend that way, there's something that I miss that they get that I value, but figuring out how to channel the person who everything they see, they immediately can break down everything that's wrong with it, channeling that into a way that is life-giving and productive towards their goals instead of that inhibits them from doing things because they know how they would criticize everything. So they would never want to produce something that's not perfect themselves, and it's never going to be perfect, so they never produce anything. Like, how do you channel that? And that's a struggle I have. Like, my son's personality is more that way. And I really struggle to not just be like...
overthinking.
To just be like, oh, so all you do is overthink your perfectionist. You just criticize everything. Just go create some stuff. Because there's a real value to it. The way he can dissect a movie and give you a movie review or something, it's actually, there's some brilliance to it. But channeling that in a way, I don't know, because it's not my personality. So I'm like a fish out of water.
So here's one observation. I don't want to overgeneralize, but when I see a lot of people with that critic mindset, super easy job at finding stuff that's wrong, always talking about what's wrong, many of those people also have a victim mindset where they're constantly frustrated by people who won't debate them.
Why won't you debate me, Isaac? Why won't you respond to my comment, Andrew? You know, yeah, it's because you're not intellectually honest. And I think people who get caught up in that, where they can learn from the creator mindset, is the thing that we all have to do in order to gain attention in the real world. And that is, you got to command the respect. You've got to earn my attention. You've got to find a way to say what you say that makes me want to listen and to dialogue with you. And I think many people who love to criticize, they kind of have this entitlement mindset about other people's attention, and they're always frustrated that no one is going to debate them. I have this superior argument and you're not listening. Well, welcome to the world of people who create things. In the real world, where you have to create things, you earn people's attention. Even if you have a great product, even if you have a great service, nobody owes it to you in the name of your arguments about being intellectually honest to give you their time. Earn it. Doesn't matter how good your arguments are. Earn the attention. And that takes a creator's mindset. You got to go beyond being a critic to do that.
Was that your free stater you'd started to say?
Oh,
sorry, I interrupted.
No.
Because it sounds like it'd be the perfect follow-up for that kind of...
Yeah, I mean...
Were you pretty involved in the Free State?
I moved there, and within a couple short years, I sort of stepped back and just continued to step away. But yeah, it's a bunch of critics that got together, and that's all they do. They critique.
And it's
not a lot of creators. There really isn't. And anyone who is creating or on a path to growth tends to step away.
That's what's hard about sort of libertarianism in general. It's critiquing
everything.
The best critiques of the status quo.
Yep.
Very good at breaking down and accurate and correct in most cases. All these things that are wrong. If you get so good at that, it becomes really hard. And that's what sort of I was kind of in, like, you know, not nonprofits that were kind of libertarian, free market, sort of professional libertarian movement type spaces for a while. And I just felt like I got to get out of here and go build something, because trying to change people's beliefs through direct argumentation, it's going to work for 5% of the population.
Right.
Well, creating also an alternative experience, instead of trying to argue about what's wrong with higher ed and win an argument, how about I just say build something and I got to get out of here, because otherwise I'm going to be helpless. I'm going to be a basement dweller who can win arguments in my own head, but I can't bring any change to the world because I'm not offering any experiences that are superior.
And you get caught in this self-righteous trap of saying, I know that I'm right, but nobody cares about the truth anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the world of creativity, you can't afford yourself that luxury. You don't get to say, I know that my product's amazing, but no one's buying.
But I don't
think, can't lie to yourself.
I don't think
way.
You're one or the other. You're not a creator or a critic. I think it depends who you're dealing with. You know, you can be the creator at any cost, but if you're talking to somebody that you feel compelled to be that critic and debate, you could get sucked right into that for better or worse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We got like 5 minutes. So, because I know...
make the most of it.
Can I tell you why I do love debate, though? Because I sound like a guy that believes... Hey, so here's why I do love debate. When you listen to podcasts or different thought leaders and so forth, it feels like everybody goes on all the same shows, they do all the same speaking circuits, and they get the luxury of expressing beliefs, all the talking points from their latest book, in an environment that is not challenged at all. Right. And to me, there's something very interesting about seeing what your idea looks like when it's presented in the face of contrast. So Isaac and I joke about this experience he had once where there's this guy talking to a bunch of other guys and he's like some military dude and he's like talking about being tough and being a man. And then his wife calls in the middle of that conversation and he starts whispering. He's like, yeah, I'm sorry, baby. Okay. Yeah. I'll be right there. And then he hangs up and he's like a little embarrassed, but then he goes back into his like being a tough guy talk. And it's like, yeah, I don't want to hear what that tough guy, how to be a man speech sounds like when you're giving it in a context where everybody thinks like you. I want to see what that conversation looks like when your wife's there, right? I want to know how your ideas hold up when someone's challenging it with the best things that can be said about it. And that's why I love debates, man, because you get a chance to see that and it really differentiates
that
people's
thinking. Key and Peele sketch.
Yeah.
I told my woman, I said, and he looks around to make sure she's nowhere near and he's like whispers.
When you can find those people and it can be more an open exchange, even if it gets tense and exciting, mm-hmm. that's fine. It's just, it's been a challenge to find like people who are critics who I would want to talk to.
Yep.
Is that just, should I raise my pain tolerance? I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't think I want to.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. The more I think about it, I've done some debates and stuff. I did a debate on higher ed at that Voice and Exit conference and was like immediately regretted it. For me, I think it's also just that I lack the self-control that Brett, TK, you guys have. I don't like who I become when I start debating. I don't like who I become when I engage in.
I really can't control.
I get too fired up and I have a feeling in me that I don't like.
Yeah.
I don't want to be that.
I turn into like ultra conservative and it's, I'm not. I used to, you know, it doesn't make sense, but that's the argument I'm making.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would like to find more people like that.
More people who can have good debates.
But maybe it's like the idea that debate needs to evolve. Like we don't say this is a debate, we're debating. But like put people like, all right, so one of the guys I interviewed for the virtual summit that I have coming up, Jay Dyer. You guys know who Jay Dyer is?
No.
It's a site called Jay's Analysis, right?
Okay.
So years ago, Jay was just doing these movie reviews movie analysis, not movie reviews, where he'd look at all the symbols, the hidden symbols in meetings and movies. And then he wrote this book called Esoteric Hollywood, right? So that's
I've heard of that book.
And he had a show on Gaia TV too, but that's his big open funnel where he gets all these people diving in. Yeah, like what's the story behind Eyes Wide Shut? What's happening in that movie? But he talks a lot about theology. He's Orthodox. He's a monarchist, and I'm neither of those things, right? I love this guy.
Yeah.
I can't wait to hear what he's going to say next. And I like just the tension of having, the idea of the tension of having a conversation with him, or maybe a couple other people. He's been on my show a couple times. I think it was on his show once or twice. And just like, oh, God, we could certainly touch a live wire here.
Yeah.
You know? And that's even if it doesn't happen, just to be talking to somebody who's like, very intelligent, but also personable. Like we talked in the summit about this, like lead with your personality, right? Like if you have things to say that are going to be uncomfortable, like they better like you.
Yeah.
You better make them laugh.
And you got to own it.
Yeah.
Totally own
it. Yeah. That you lead with your personality, lead with humor, you know, let people in that way.
Would you say that, because I'm thinking of like, there are different interviews and things I've heard, I can't think of a specific one right now, where the people talking to each other do have very different opinions
mm-hmm.
that go really well and I find interesting, but it's typically when both are very curious truth seekers who are not threatened.
I think Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson, their debate was a good example of that.
Yeah, where it's like, or sometimes you hear a Joe Rogan or whatever, some guy will have some really weird idea.
Yep.
But it's like, it almost helps if the idea is so out there that you don't know how to be offended by it. So I've found this, for example, if I were to tell people like, oh, I favor less taxes, less regulation, a lot of people get all offended and it turns into a debate. Mm-hmm. If I say, oh, I just don't believe in the concept of government, period, there's almost no time where I have ticked people off and gotten into it because it's so far outside of their paradigm. They're like, really? That's weird. Tell me about that. And it's almost like you got to find like really out there ideas and so that they're not threatening because you almost don't know what to put them in, or like monarchism. Like, I don't even know what to do with that. It doesn't seem like anyone's about to become a monarch. So I'm not threatened by it. I'm like, interesting. Okay. Talk to me.
Just like, tell me more. Exactly. It's like, that's the only place you could go. But right. If you have an issue that's already been politicized, yes. Like I say on my show all the time, like you could have a conversation in the year 2000, you could have a conversation about getting on an airplane without it turning into a political one.
Yeah.
In 2006, that wasn't possible anymore, right? Yeah. In 2005, you could have a conversation about going to the doctor without it becoming a political conversation. But in 2012, that wasn't possible.
So now we got to move out there. We got to have conversations about whether we're living in a simulation or really wild things that are, right. Non-politicizable yet.
And so, one thing about this too, though, I think it's about the context rather than the people that are debating. I don't want to limit debaters to people who have built brands, but there's something about writing a book. There's something about writing an essay, going on a podcast that indicates a willingness to invest in your ideas that minimizes the probability of unproductive conversation. So for instance, one experiment I've done on social media, I've done this a few times, only two people have taken me up on it, where I've gotten into long-winded debates with people on Facebook or Twitter. I said, all right, if you really want to go further in this issue, let's arrange a Zoom call and you and I will talk about it. And two people have taken me up on that. Most people disappear and run away because it's like, oh, wait a minute. You want to take away the audience. You want to take away the pissing contest that we're having here on Facebook. Mm-hmm. You want me to actually do the work of scheduling a phone call with you and talk to you face to face for 30 minutes on this idea? Oh, no, I don't care about it that much. I just wanted to use your brand as a space for me to like show up and show out in front of your audience. And like it really does purify the intent. It really does separate the wheat from the chaff. And this is why I think having moderated debates, having podcast debates is usually a good context, because in order to get into that conversation, you have to be willing to invest time and energy into actually caring about the truth, not just, having a low-cost pissing match on the internet.
Right. Absolutely.
You're creating a property right around your social media property and saying, there's a price if you want to use my platform.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I would never do it, but I like it.
Well, I know we're out of time. I want to thank you both for having us here. This has been really great.
This is awesome. Impromptu. We got to do this again where we have a little more time and some better equipment, because I feel like we just started to get into the groove.
Yeah, but unfortunately, on that high note, that's it for us. This is the last recording of any of our podcasts.
All three podcasts are shutting down.
Well, just in closing, I'm very happy to be here. I obviously have always wanted to come here and visit you guys. Praxis is a really awesome example of what we talk about on my show, which is why you guys get mentioned every other show. So I'm happy to finally be here. I'm happy to be sitting here
in front of a big Praxis logo.
Yeah, it's very hard for me to go through my daily life and not talk to all these kids and all these people I deal with and just say, yeah, get out of this four-year school. Let's go meet these guys.
Send them over to Praxis.
I wish I could, but I would lose my
amen. I felt that way before. All right, thanks, guys.
Hey, thank you, guys.